There you go, boys and girls. That's a request from one of our good buddies out there. Good babes. I don't know which. I never ask. Maybe halfway in between. Yeah, but that's Too Much Heaven from 1979. The Bay Jays, and that goes out to the She-Wolves out there, the War She-Wolves. And I hope they like that. And I know we got one person that really likes the Bee Gees. I think they're cool. Yeah, I do. I do. Compared to the anthropoid nonsense we hear on the radio from one end of the dial to the other today, those are classic. Yeah. Terrible Tommy here in the bunker bright and early today. Spent some time working on my cable system. Boy, everything's needing fixed around here. Remember that song, This Old House? This Old House? Let's play that. Let's play that. Now, this is the original recording of that from Stuart Hamblin. A lot of you people don't remember. Maybe none of you remember. Stuart Hamblin was quite a singer back in the day. He was sort of a Christian-oriented guy. He ran for president in the 70s on the Prohibition ticket. And his office was right out here in Winona Lake, Indiana. Yeah, so here we go.
This old house once knew my children. This old house once knew my wife. This old house was home and comfort as we fought the storms of life. This old house once rang with laughter. This old house heard many shouts. Now she trembles in the darkness when the lightning walks about.
Ain't gonna need this house no longer. Ain't gonna need this house no more.
Ain't got time to fix the shingles. Ain't got time to fix the floor. Ain't got time to oil the hinges. Not to mend the window pane. Ain't gonna need this house no longer. I'm a getting ready to leave the same. This old house is a getting shaky. This old house is a getting old. This old house lets in the rain. This old house lets in the cold. Oh, my knees, I'm getting chilly, but I feel no fear of pain, 'cause I see an angel peeking through a broken window pane.
Ain't you gonna need this house no longer. Ain't you gonna need this house no more.
Ain't got time to fix the shingles. Ain't got time to fix the floor. Ain't got time to oil the hinges. Not to mend the window pane. Ain't gonna need this house no longer. I'm getting ready to meet the saints. This old house is afraid of thunder. This old house is afraid of storms. This old house just groans and trembles when the night wind flings its arms. This old house is getting feeble. This old house is needing paint. Just like me, it's tuckered out, but I'm getting ready to meet the saints.
Ain't you gonna need this house no longer. Ain't you gonna need this house no more.
Ain't got time to fix the shingles. Ain't got time to fix the floor. Ain't got time to oil the hinges. Not to mend the window pane. Ain't gonna need this house no longer. I'm a getting ready to meet the same. Now my old hound dog lies asleep, and he don't know I'm gonna leave. Else he'd wake up by the fireplace, and he'd sit there and howl and grieve. But my hunting days are over. Ain't gonna hunt the coon no more. Gabriel Dunn brought in my chariot when the wind blew down the door.
Ain't gonna need this house no longer. Ain't gonna need this house no more.
Ain't got time to fix the shingles. Ain't got time to fix the floor. Ain't got time to oil the hinges. Not to mend the window pane. Ain't gonna need this house no longer. I'm getting ready to meet the saints.
Ready to meet the saints.
I hope you heard that verse in there where it says the lightning stomps around. Well, the lightning stomped around here pretty good, man. Wow, I told you about it. I'm still shuddering about it, man. It was like a howitzer going off. Yeah. So anyhow, that old song is pretty apropos. This old house was a kit house. It was put together back in the, about 1960, 59 or 60. And so it's been around. It's been around. Still haven't got my last or my one main problem fixed, and that's a 110-volt line running through the house and serves about 6 or 8 outlets and a water heater. And I still haven't figured that out. It's shorted. Normally they open up, but this is shorted, man, I'll tell you. So I had to make temporary provisions for things to work around here. That's what, you know, if you know something, a little something about everything, you can get along a lot cheaper because you know how to string drop cords around and borrow power from one area to another area. Yeah, all kinds of stuff like that. Take from one outlet and power up the water heater. We're doing just fine until I find myself somebody who can really trace that out. And this old house was has so many old lines in it, and I don't know who all did the wiring. And my mother, years ago, put a beauty shop in one end of the house and wired the place for 220. And she's got all kinds of wires running back and forth that went to that. I got twice as many power cables in this house as I need. So when you go to try to figure it out, no matter how much you know about electronics, or tracing circuits, it gives you a problem, man. You got to watch it. Anyhow, I love that old song. You know, I was coming home from the VA yesterday, and I was listening to, what the hell's his name? He's on the radio telling people how to get out of debt all the time. He's damn good at what he does. And some poor guy called in. His father's spending all his savings on a scam down in Jamaica. Now, you know, you used to receive that stuff all the time. It's not near as much as it used to be. But he's put in over $100,000, giving it to these idiot niggers down there in Jamaica on a scam. Makes you wonder sometimes who is the smartest. Well, I'll tell you, it's terrible. If you have a relative or even yourself, if you get these calls from Africa and Jamaica and all over, they're going to make you a lot of money. All you have to do is send them money, and then they'll send you a whole bunch of money back. Don't do anything like that. Yeah, I got here's one I got today. Now, this is a new twist. You guys may get something like this, so watch out, because they've learned to use our own politics against us. Greetings. I lie here on my deathbed, an accomplished businessman, a proud father and a wife, a respected member of the community. Dying is difficult, but a man in my position at the end of such a life as I've led should be able to pass in peace and contentment. I've built communities. I've furthered our people's aims. I've raised 2 generations of conscious men and women who will fight on the streets, in the courts, and in the minds of the white race. Okay, back to the letter. I've furthered our people's aims. I've raised 2 generations of conscious men and women who will fight in the streets, in the courts, and in the minds of the white race. I have good feelings for my children. All but one is my daughter, whom I do not feel comfortable naming explicitly, though I will refer to her as Sarah below and in further correspondence. Has been an ungrateful, arrogant monster since she left for that damn communist garbage heap, Vassar College, 40 years ago. She denies God, gives to the Democrats, and fornicates with other women, and calls us racist, bigoted Philistines. She had been gone from my life for decades, but through some grapevine, she'd heard about my imminent condition and hatched a scheme to steal my estate. She has gone, and some crafty Jew law degree, and now she's assumed power of attorney over me through forged and fraudulent documentations. I own tracts and tracts of prime farming land, and she plans to sell it to a big New York corporation. She mocks me and says she's going to use the money to get herself scientifically inseminated with a nigger sperm. I need to get this land donated somehow, or sell it, and distribute the cash to organizations like yours that can carry on the fight and push back this liberal misogynistic storm. I have $20 million in real estate that could soon go up in flames. Wow. Well, there you go. Very cleverly crafted, if it's phony, and most likely is. But I did send him a return letter and told him what we stood for and to give me the details on what he wants me to do. I think he probably wants me to off his daughter, which I'm not inclined to do. But anyhow, we'll see. So be careful, because there's probably going to be more of this kind of thing crafted a la maybe by the Jamaicans. I don't know. But it's clever if it's phony. But if it happened to be true, I don't put much confidence in these things. They never turn out the way they say. So that's that. Oh, yeah, the first name on the guy going to make me rich. Sheldon. How about that? Yeah, good old Sheldon. Well, it's all over the internet, newspapers all over the world, that Mike Pence, the vice presidential candidate, declines to call David Duke deplorable. Well, that's because Indiana used to be one of the biggest Klan states in the United States. The Klan elected governors and everything else. And it was a pretty strong pro-sympathizers during the Civil War, too. Lots of cool things happened in this state. Maybe Mike Pence is a secret Klansman. One of those leaked emails from the General Powell, that asshole. He's hated by half the military. And where he said former U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell told a colleague last year that Israel has a slew of nuclear weapons pointed at Iran. Maybe 200 nukes pointed at them. I doubt whether they got 200 nukes pointed at them, but why aren't we telling the Jews they got to get rid of their nukes? Laugh, laugh. There might be Jews that want to get rid of the nukes too, but it's the evangelical Christians that push the Jews into even more warlike than they are. Yeah, they sure do. Oh, did you hear yesterday that the Honorable Presidente has signed a deal to give Israel a package of $38 billion worth of military aid? $38 billion. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. Here's information you have to know about, because there's a move on in Israel to run Netanyahu, the premier of Israel, for U.S. presidency. Yeah! With many in the U.S. in despair over their options in the upcoming presidential election, an Israeli radio personality decided to ask Americans their thoughts on a potential alternative. Asaf Lieberman, the host of Good Morning Israel program on Army Radio, took a camera and a microphone to New York City's Central Park and presented passerbys with a new candidate, Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Nitwit, who spent many of his childhood and young adult years in the U.S. and speaks fluent English. The response Lieberman received were mixed. Quote, I can't see him as president here, one man said. He is great for Israel. He can stay in Israel and fight for Israel there. Quote, "I love him in Israel," the woman echoed. A second man said, quote, "We support his policy in leading Israel, but I'm not sure about America. He's totally different." The next interviewee had the warmest praise for the prime minister, saying, "He's a remarkable politician and a great statesman and a great leader and very intelligent man. And that's why he could be a better president than anyone," unquote. Quote, "No thank you," the first said. There were two respondents here. Quote, "He's not able to solve the problems in his home. How's he going to solve problems in other countries?" the second elaborated. Another young man admitted to knowing nothing about Netanyahu, but promised he would vote for him 1,000%. The final interviewee took a cynical approach. "At the end of the day, all politicians, they lie," he said. "Honestly, he's like a late middle-aged white man, so he probably represents most of the country. So yeah, fuck it. He could be president." That was a Negro in Israel. Okay, so there you go. They're going to get Netanyahu over here. That'll solve the problem. Well, do you know about the private prisoners fiasco? Prison? Do you know about it? Do you know how bad it is in there for our guys, especially in these private prisons, whose investors, mostly white, are making a fortune off the misery of white prisoners? Yes, I know there's a lot of black prisoners and mestizo prisoners, but I'm talking about white prisoners. It's getting rougher and rougher. Well, finally, to his good nature, Obama has, he's going to dismantle the private prisons, and that's very good. He's probably doing it to help out black guys, but he's going to inadvertently help out white guys. But I want you to hear an expose on what private prisoners were like and the corruption involved in the private prisons. So here we go.
He's in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. We're speaking with investigative reporter Seth Fried Wessler, who spent much of the last 4 years looking into conditions at privately run prisons in the federal correction system. The Justice Department announced last week it would phase out the use of private prisons. Wessler's stories appeared in The Nation. Let's talk about how this whole financial arrangement works and how it might connect to some of these issues. You know, a lot of the services that government provides aren't provided by public employees. They're done on in private contracts, you know, building roads. I mean, typically private construction companies competitively bid for work. They complete it. It's inspected and they're paid. Let's talk about how it works for prisons. How does a contract typically work for a private prison? It must be a big, expensive thing to build a prison. How long are the contracts? What are the provisions? What are the standards and the methods for making sure that the contractors live up to them?
So the Bureau of Prisons puts out calls for proposals when they want to open a new private prison. And a group of companies, at this point really only three companies, Corrections Corporation of America, Geo Group, and a company called Management and Training Corporation, bid for these contracts. The contracts usually last about 10 years, and during that period of time, there are points when the Bureau of Prisons can decide whether to extend the contract further. One of the main reasons that the federal government decided to contract in the first place is that it believed that contractors could save money. And there are real questions about whether that's actually happened. But even if the prisons cost about the same, which is what research suggests, what's different about private prisons from prisons run by governments is that, let's say you're spending, the government spends $100 per prisoner. In a public prison, a prison run by the government, all of that money is going to the management of the facility. But in the context of private prisons, some of that money is profit for these companies. And so there is an incentive to cut down on costs. And one of the most expensive parts of federal prisons, of prisons in general, is the operation of medical care. What I found in my reporting, interviewing people who worked inside these prisons, is that there was this sort of constant pressure to cut costs, a culture of austerity inside of these facilities. I talked to an older doctor in his mid-80s, a man named John Farquhar, who worked for several years as the prison doctor in Big Spring Prison, a private facility in West Texas run by the GEO Group. Just days after he arrived, took the job as the medical director at Big Spring, his corporate bosses arrived to tell him that they felt that they needed to cut down on the number of 911 calls made out of the prison because those calls cost too much money.
Those are cases where they need an ambulance to get someone to a higher level of care?
That's right. You know, I came across this doctor because through a Freedom of Information Act request, I obtained thousands of pages of medical records of men who had died in these facilities, 103 men who died inside of these facilities. And in some of those records, I found notes from nurses or physician's assistants, and in this case, from the physician. And in those notes, it was remarkable because not only was he appearing to provide sort of more care and a higher level of care than most of the other doctors in the facilities that I looked at were providing, that is, in facilities that had doctors at all, but he left these sort of indignant notes behind about how upset he was about the quality of care that he was able to provide. He said in one note, this prisoner will almost certainly die. This was in the context of a case where he had been trying to transfer somebody out to get care outside of the prison, and he was told by his corporate bosses that he wouldn't be allowed to do that. In another note, he wrote, I feel badly for the shabby care. You know, this is a guy who clearly wanted to be providing higher quality medical care. He'd been a doctor for decades. He'd been a military doctor. He's now a doctor for the Veterans Administration in Texas. And he felt that these pressures to cut costs made that very difficult to do.
You know, I'm sure it's not easy to get highly trained medical personnel to work in a prison system. It's not the kind of environment most medical professionals would imagine working in. They're often in remote places. So there is going to be a difficulty, I think, in getting good quality people to do that, and they're probably going to have to pay more. Is that addressed at all when this arrangement was set up? I mean, it's simply going to, you're going to have to spend some money, aren't you, to take care of literally thousands of people who can have health issues.
That's right. You know, the Bureau of Prisons across the board has struggled to fully staff its medical units, and that's especially a problem in rural areas where it's hard to find doctors to come and work. But there were facilities in my investigation that for months, nearly a year in some cases, had no medical doctor at all, or who significantly understaffed their nursing departments for months and months at a time. In fact, the Office of Inspector General from the Department of Justice found in a previous investigation that a prison called Reeves in West Texas, another GEO Group run facility, was systematically understaffing its medical unit. And only after the investigation did that begin to change. But the fact that it did change after the investigation suggests that it's a problem that could be fixed and that the contractors weren't fixing.
You know, you said that in these private prisons, which are for non-citizens, I mean, typically illegal immigrants who were caught trying to re-enter the country, they're designed to have fewer services, rehabilitative services, educational program, addiction counseling, mental health services. But they are supposed to provide some standard of medical care and decent living conditions. And as with all government contracts, there's a monitoring system, right? Somebody's supposed to come in regularly, examine the conditions, review records, and see whether the public is getting what it's paying for to these private companies. You looked at a lot of these monitoring reports. What did they show?
Well, so after the Bureau of Prisons set up this system of private facilities, it also set up what is really a pretty robust system of contract monitoring. So it hires a couple of people for each facility to actually be on site and watch over what the facilities are doing. And then every year or every 6 months, a group of monitors trained very specifically in subject areas go into these facilities to check to see if the prisons are following the terms of the contract. I obtained nearly a decade of these monitoring reports, and the reports show that for years, monitors documented deep and systemic problems in these facilities, and the monitors would send these reports back to Washington. And What I found is that despite these ongoing problems, officials in Washington, contracting officials in Washington, didn't impose the full fines or use their full enforcement muscle available to them to force changes inside of these facilities. In fact, the Office of Inspector General report from the Department of Justice that came out recently found that when prisoners died inside of these facilities and those deaths were connected to medical negligence, that the Bureau of Prisons didn't have an effective way to force the companies to correct those problems. And so prisoners would die and the problems would go on.
Now, the contracts provided for specific monetary penalties, right? I mean, this is the way you build a contract. I mean, if you don't deliver the service, you are penalized, and presumably for-profit providers would pay a lot of attention. As you looked at these records, in cases where monitors said things are not working here, people are being endangered, do you have a sense of why financial penalties weren't imposed? What led to those sets of decisions?
I interviewed a number of former Bureau of Prison monitors who were tasked with overseeing the operations and contracts of these facilities. And what I found was that on-the-ground monitors were proposing quite significant fines when things went wrong. So when a facility failed to provide prisoners with infectious disease care, or a prisoner died as a result of not receiving the kind of medical care that they needed, that the on-site monitors would ask the Bureau of Prisons in Washington to impose significant fines. But what they said, a number of federal monitors told me this, including fairly high-level people who were tasked with overseeing the contracts, what they said was that those fines were repeatedly either made smaller or refused altogether by federal officials in Washington, that the full fines that could have been imposed for deficiencies, for failures to meet the terms of the contract, simply weren't imposed at all. And in some cases, federal contract monitors proposed closing facilities that had repeatedly failed, and they were told by their bosses in Washington that they wouldn't be allowed to close those facilities. Instead, contracts were renewed repeatedly with failing facilities.
Were there ever cases where there were questions about whether some of the for-profit correctional companies might have had influence on decisions in the Bureau of Prisons?
One of these private facilities, the Adams County Correctional Center in Natchez, Mississippi, it was the site in 2012 of a pretty major riot that left 20 people injured and a prison guard was killed in this riot. The riot erupted after complaints about poor conditions inside, significantly about medical care, and really left a stain on that facility. After the riot, federal monitors who were tasked with overseeing the operations of this facility proposed to senior bureau administrators that the prison lose its contract, that they shut the facility down. And my sources, former Bureau of Prisons monitors who were tasked with overseeing these contracts, say that they were told by their bosses in Washington that they wouldn't be allowed to close the contract. The contract with CCA was renewed in 2013 and again in July of 2015. What my sources tell me is that one of the factors that stopped this contract from being closed down were the close ties between present Bureau of Prisons officials and officials in CCA who had formerly worked for the Bureau of Prisons, in particular a man named Harley Lappin, who was the director of the Bureau of Prisons and left in 2011, immediately taking a pretty lucrative contract with CCA.
That's the private prisons facility, right? The Corrections Corporation of America.
That's right. So he left his job in government and took a job earning more than $1 million for Corrections Corporation of America. And my sources tell me that the refusal by senior bureau officials to close the facility down was in part a result of conversations and close ties between Mr. Lappin and existing Bureau of Prisons officials, that Mr. Lappin was pressing the Bureau of Prisons not to close the Adams County facility and that the contract was renewed. In 2015, the key Bureau of Prisons official who blocked the termination, the end of the CCA contract to run Adams County. He also left his job at the BOP and has taken a contract with CCA, with Corrections Corporation, as a consultant as well.
You tried to reach all of the principals involved here as well as the company, Corrections Corporation of America. What does everyone say about this?
Corrections Corporation of America, who responded for itself and for Harley Lappin, said that no ethics laws had been broken. The former Bureau of Prisons official who recently left kicked responsibility for the Adams County contract to other people in the Bureau of Prisons and said that no wrongdoing had happened. But the facility in Adams County remains open. Its contract was renewed a year ago. And what I found in my reporting is that federal monitors, just after the contract was renewed following the riot, found that five people had died in that very facility in the wake of clearly substandard medical care. And yet the contract was renewed again after that.
Seth Wessler is an investigative journalist who has just completed a two-year investigation of the operations of private prisons for The Nation. We'll continue our conversation. We're speaking with Seth Wessler. He's an investigative journalist who just completed a two-year look at the operation of private prisons in the United States for The Nation. The Justice Department has announced it will begin phasing out private correctional facilities. The Justice Department has said it wants to phase out the use of these private correctional facilities. What will be the immediate impact and what will happen more long term?
So the Justice Department has ordered the Bureau of Prisons to start to shrink and eventually end its use of private facilities. Over the next couple of years, the number will start to fall, and within 5 years, the number of federal prisoners in private facilities will be zeroed out. The announcement follows a report from the Department of Justice's Inspector General that found that after 20 years of operation, the facilities simply don't save meaningfully on costs and significantly diminish the quality of operations inside of the facilities. There's more violence inside, there's more contraband found inside of these facilities, and they found that the Bureau of Prisons is not meaningfully overseeing and monitoring the medical care provided inside of these contract facilities. What's striking is that the Bureau of Prisons has actually known these things for years. And in my reporting, I found story after story of people who were left to suffer significantly inside of these prisons. I reported on the story of a man named Jesus Enrique Zavala, who was 28 years old when he arrived at the Taft facility in California. He arrived and told nursing staff who interviewed him that he had suffered previously from mental illness, had taken medication for bipolar disorder and anxiety, and had previously attempted suicide. And he was nonetheless provided no substantive mental health care. And he was left in a solitary cell where, after weeks of being basically left alone with any real attention from anyone, was found hanging in his cell. He committed suicide there. One of the things that's striking about prisons in general is that prisoners are cut off from their communities. But in these facilities, prisoners are sort of doubly cut off because not only are they behind prison bars, their families, often the first line advocates for them, are often over borders. And so in this case, this man's family actually didn't learn that he had died for a whole year after his death. And they didn't know why he had died. That is, they didn't know he had killed himself until I was able to call them and tell them what I had found in this medical file.
Do the three companies that run the federal private prisons also operate state and local prisons?
Yeah. Corrections Corporation of America, GEO Group, and Management and Training Corporation are the biggest players in private incarceration around the country. They have contracts with states and with the Department of Homeland Security to operate detention centers. And they're starting to get into other areas as well. So in addition to managing prisons, private corrections companies also manage transportation for prisoners. They're getting contracts for mental health care, and they manage post-release surveillance. So there's many other ways that private prison companies are making money on the criminal justice system. In the scheme of their business, this is a relatively small part, but it sends a big message. The Department of Justice sees this as a message to states and to other federal agencies as well, that private prisons just don't provide the services that they expect.
And do we have any idea how much money these firms make in this business?
It varies firm to firm. Federal contracts make up about half of Correction Corporation of America's business, but that includes the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security. These federal prison contracts make up between about 5 and 15% of business for the companies that run them.
And do they make tens of millions, billions?
Yeah, the contracts are for tens of millions of dollars a year. Those are major losses for each of these companies. So as these facilities close over the next several years, these companies will be looking for new ways to make profit.
Seth Wessler, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My guest, Patrick Phillips, is the author of the new book, Blood at the Root, A Racial Cleansing in America. It's about how the people of his hometown, Forsyth County, drove out the entire black population in 1912 after a young white woman was raped and beaten to death. All of the suspects arrested were black. Two were convicted and executed by hanging. Another suspect, Rob Edwards, was abducted from the jail, beaten to death by a white mob, then lynched. Was anybody prosecuted for the lynching of Rob Edwards who was not tried?
Yeah, there's no evidence of any arrest, indictment, prosecution of any of the crimes committed in the entire, in the entire history of this racial cleansing, from the lynch, from the whipping of Grant Smith the week earlier, to the lynching of Rob Edwards, to eventually the burning of churches, burning of sharecroppers' cabins. I found no records of any arrests or prosecution the entire time. And another of the myths that I grew up with was the notion that, well, that was just those days. That was just the way it was back then. It was the Jim Crow South. It was a racist time. And that was often, I was often told that as a way of kind of excusing the whole thing. But then I did some research on the neighboring county, Hall County, which was just across the Chattahoochee River. And at the same period, they had similar waves of white terrorism and similar attempts to drive out the black community. But there was a key difference, which is in the first week of the violence, arrests were made, the newspapers printed the names of the night riders, and those, you know, a group of about six men were tried, convicted, and sentenced to jail time in Hall County. And later the sheriff said, you know, we managed to, quote, crush this thing in its infancy. So for me, it became a very interesting experiment in that on one side of the river, you had a county where white terrorism went unpunished and then spread and lasted almost 100 years. On the other side of the river, in the very earliest days, you know, the enforcement of existing laws managed to stop it.
You describe a festival-like atmosphere at this public execution, but public executions were illegal at the time in Forsyth County. They were supposed to be doing these hangings in an enclosed space so that the public wouldn't see. So what happened there?
So yeah, that was the judge's order when the judge's name was Newt Morris, and he's also an interesting figure in that he later emerges in 1915 leading a lynch mob himself in the lynching of a guy named Leo Frank in Atlanta. That's another story told in the book. But yeah, the judge ordered that the hanging happen behind a blind, that there should be a 15-foot-high fence raised around the gallows to shield them from view and to keep any spectators from seeing what was going on. And, you know, the short version is that the night before the hanging, a group of whites came to the area where that had been erected and burned the fence down. But very tellingly, they left the gallows completely untouched. So there was a real conspiracy for everyone to see this. And, you know, in a lot of ways, it had the atmosphere of a lynching as well, that people took souvenirs after the hanging. They took pieces of the noose, and in fact, one of the pieces of the noose ended up in the minute book of the court records that were in the county courthouse, and it vanished not long after Forsyth got a lot of attention in 87, but up until the mid-1980s, when you went to look at the minute book for the records of these two trials of Ernest Knox and Oscar Daniel, the page was marked with a piece of the rope from the hanging. Mm.
Were you able to find photographs of the hangings or of the crowds witnessing the execution?
You know, I did not find any photographs. I found lots of descriptions. My search for photographs was interesting in that one of the places where I think I might have found such a photograph was in the Forsyth County newspaper. I relied on a lot of newspapers from Atlanta, from places as far away as the New York Times, and especially Gainesville, the town next door. But one of the really gaping holes in the record is the Forsyth County News, which was publishing Incoming, the closest newspaper, you know, right in the middle of all of this. And the issues from the relevant months are nowhere to be found. I actually went to the University of Georgia Library, and where there's a place called the Georgia Newspaper Project, and they have microfilms of all of these. And literally, I opened the drawer, and the two boxes that would contain September and October of the Forsyth County News from 1912, there's just a space there. You know, it's hard to say exactly what to make of that, but it certainly seems there's been some effort to deflect attention away from all of this.
My guest is Patrick Phillips, author of the new book, Blood at the Root. The title is taken from the lyric of a song about lynching.
So don't forget all of our fallen ones in prison, even the ones who get religion after they got into prison, if they're honest about it, in these private prisons. Now remember, most of these prisons and the investors in the prisons are white, and most of them are probably would say they're white Christians, and they have no qualms of torturing white activists like you and me. So I want you to remember that. And I knew a man and his wife about 35 years ago, I believe it was, quite a while back. His name was James, Mr. James. When I came in contact with them, I was in the TV business and took care of their television. And Mr. James was blind. He could just see some red on his TV screen. That's all he could see. But he essentially was blind. And he related to me how he had come over here from Britain. And he had worked in the mines over there. He came to the United States, and he lived back in Georgia, and one day he was walking, and he met Woodrow Wilson walking down the street. He also told me that later he became a Klansman after they'd moved here to California, and he joined up at the big KKK building in downtown L.A., which was flourishing at the time, and he explained to me how there were two halls side by side. One was for the natural citizens, white citizens that were Klansmen, and one was for the foreign-born Klansmen. And they met separately, but in the same building. He also related to me that he was there on the day they lynched Leo Frank. He was in the crowd, and that goes back a long way, but that's quite a bit of history there. So we used to sit around and talk about his history quite a bit. But he was about 90, he was over 90 years old when he talked to me. I also talked to a man way back, decades ago, who was very, very old, and he had been a guard at the Tsar's palace in Russia at the time the revolution came about. Interesting man to talk to. And I used to know another old man who ran the railroad down in Mexico. And he used to haul weapons and so forth down there. And he saw the Mexican Revolution with Pancho Villa. He was there. Told me how young white guys used to go to downtown San Diego and sign on to the revolution. The revolution was paying cash money in silver and gold. And a lot of them would ride motorcycles down to Mexico to join up with the revolution. And they'd be paid in silver or gold, but the problem was silver and gold's quite heavy. And they were moving around a lot, so they'd get too heavy, and then they'd have to figure some place to hide it. And that was a real difficult problem. as you can imagine, or whether they'd ever get back to it. So it's very interesting, a lot of the people I've met over the years. I also had a business associate that worked as a salesman when I was selling television and had a store in California, and he had been in the Army in the expeditionary force sent over to fight the Marxists in Russia at the time of the Russian Revolution. He was stationed over in Vladivostok. He actually ended up marrying a Russian woman. He told me a lot of stories about that, enough that I researched how many dead American soldiers were killed fighting the Reds way back there, way back in the teens. And subsequently, I tracked down a cemetery up here in Michigan where there appears to be about 100 graves of purely of the men who fought and died fighting Marxism in the original Russian Revolution. And I'm trying to remember the exact location, but you could find it. It's in lower Michigan. Quite interesting. Of course, nobody thinks about it or knows about it anymore or cares about it. As I recall, it was pretty much overgrown. But that was an interesting piece of information I gleaned out of the historical record. Let's see if I can run this piece on "There Never Was an Al-Qaeda." Ex-CIA bin Laden expert spills the beans.
Down with Michael Scheuer, the man who had served in the CIA for more than 20 years up until 2004. At one time, he was the chief of the CIA bin Laden unit. Then he went and exposed how counter-effective Washington's methods were in the fight against terror. He looked at the U.S. through its enemies' eyes. In fact, it's the title of one of his books called Through Our Enemy's Eyes. I'm very pleased to have the chance to interview you,
Thank
Mr. Scheuer.
I'm glad to be here.
Bin Laden is gone. Who is Washington's number one enemy now?
Washington's enemy is an enemy that doesn't exist. We're fighting an Islamic enemy that Washington believes is out to kill us because we have elections, because we're free, because we have women in the workplace. It's an enemy that doesn't exist. It didn't exist when Bin Laden was alive. It doesn't exist now. America is being attacked because of its foreign policy in the Muslim world, because of its support for Israel, because of its support for the Saudi police state, because of its presence on the Arab Peninsula. And until we accept that, until Americans can say to each other, whether you support aid to Israel or not, our relationship with Israel is causing this war, we are not going to be able to defeat this enemy. And Israel itself, as a country, is not the problem. The real problem is the leaders of the Jewish American community in the United States who influence and corrupt our Congress to support Israel when we have no interest there.
You imply that the Israeli lobby is dragging the United States into the wars, into
absolutely.
The conflict?
They're absolutely dragging us in. Iraq was a war that was proffered or was called for. Mainly.
Then let me ask you this. Yeah. The situation in the region, in the wake of all these revolutions in the Middle East and North Africa,
yes.
You can pretty much describe it as turmoil. Turmoil is no good for Israel. What you're saying?
Well, the American political establishment is caught between two things. They're extremely pro-Israel, and they're almost Marxist in their belief that democracy and the spread of democracy is inevitable in all places, in all peoples, at all times. And so they need to protect the Israelis, but they can't say what is a reality. For example, there is not going to be a democracy in Tunisia or Libya or Egypt that in any way resembles democracy in the West. And yet what they've done is create anarchy. They've created a situation where the only beneficiaries are the Islamists. The guns that have flown out of Egypt, out of Tunisia, out of Libya, to the Islamists have been enormous in their volume, and the prisons that were opened in Egypt, Tunisia, and Libya have reinforced the Islamist groups across the world. So their mindless pursuit of secular democracy at the end of the day endangers the stability of the region and probably the whole world.
Are you saying we're going to see further radicalization of the region?
Oh, especially in Africa. Yes, ma'am. The guns that are flowing out of the three places where there were Arab Spring revolts are going to cause problems in Somalia, across North Africa, and in Nigeria.
Let's talk about Syria.
Yes.
Syria says the earth will start shaking if anyone intervenes in their internal affairs. How badly does the U.S., is the U.S. trying to interfere?
Oh, I think we're interfering unconscionably. Until they removed the U.S. ambassador, he was running around the country trying to encourage groups to overthrow the Syrian government. That is not the role of any diplomat, United States or Russian or Chinese or British. We have really very cold-bloodedly urged Syrians to get out on the street knowing that they're going to get shot down by their government. Again, Syria is a country where there is no U.S. interest. Since I was a little boy, we've been afraid of the Syrians. And if you look at the map, it's hard to imagine that little blot of country called Syria could be a threat to the United States.
The CIA has reportedly worked with the Syrian opposition for years.
Well, I'm not sure we worked with the Syrian opposition. We've certainly worked with the Syrian
WikiLeaks
government.
Cables,
well,
Iran.
I haven't. Yeah. Well, then if that's if it's there, it's there. But our relationship with the Syrians is really a relatively unimportant one. But again, it's another very good example of the dichotomy in the thinking of American leaders. Because as we call for democracy in Syria, if Assad goes, Israel's security goes straight down.
If the region becomes a complete mess, doesn't Washington see any dangers to Israel? I mean, with Iran involved, it won't be pretty.
I think that's exactly right, ma'am. I don't know what the thinking is, except that they have come down on the belief that democracy is better for everybody. And the truth is, American and Western foreign policy interests in the Middle East have depended for 50 years on the maintenance of tyranny. Tyranny that gave us access to oil, tyranny that protected Israel, and in the last 20 years, tyrannies that persecuted Islamists to protect us. All of that is going by the wayside. And to the Israelis' credit, the Israelis are the only ones who have stood up and said democracy may not be very good for our security, and they couldn't be more correct.
About Iran, what's Washington's plan for Iran?
Whatever Israel's plan is for Iran, both parties, Republicans and Democrats, are deathly that the Israelis will attack them off their own hook. And if Israel attacks Iran, the Americans will get blamed for condoning it, whether we did or not. So I think what we're seeing is a slow, almost inexorable advance toward some kind of a conflict with Iran.
What do you make of these recent accusations that the Iranian government was trying to kill the Saudi ambassador in Washington?
I'm not in a position to know whether or not the information was accurate. But when I was a young intelligence officer, I worked against Iran and Lebanese Hezbollah. And I can tell you, in the 90s, they were meticulous in covering their tracks and only using as agents of terrorism their own people. The plot that was described by the Attorney General of the United States is a comic opera.
A Mexican drug cartel.
And to believe that the Iranians would risk war with the United States, Israel, and much of NATO to kill a Saudi ambassador who was not even part of the royal family, that's hard for me to believe.
Let's talk about Libya. Libya is in ruins in the wake of NATO bombings.
Yes.
It's brimming with weapons.
Yes.
An Al-Qaeda flag was planted over a courthouse in Benghazi.
Yes.
How good of a playground is Libya for people with radical agendas?
Very strong Islamist presence in Libya. Since the war against the Soviets in Afghanistan, Libya has sent as many of its people to fight in those insurgencies, the Islamist insurgencies, as any other country in North Africa, maybe outside of Saudi Arabia. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group fought a long time against the Soviets. They fought against Gaddafi. A great number of Libyans went to Iraq and to Afghanistan to fight us. And whatever strength the Libyan resistance had in terms of military capability, that came from experienced Islamist fighters. So the idea that somehow there's democracy afoot in Libya is just simply wrong.
Could it become a hotbed of terror?
I don't know if it could become a hotbed of terror, but it can become a country that's decidedly anti-American, anti-NATO. It can be probably less a hotbed of terror than a country that is vastly unstable.
It seems the U.S. is almost creating grounds for terrorists to surge and then goes out fighting them. We see it in Pakistan. They got the whole nation alienated because of the strikes. A lot of people want revenge. How efficient is that?
We are very efficient in this day and age, in the last 20 years, in creating enemies. We're not very efficient in creating security for the United States. We have the best educated population in the world, and we have the people with the littlest amount of common sense. How many times have we heard Mr. Clinton, Mr. Bush, Mr. Obama say, this has nothing to do with religion, this is not a religious war, this is a bunch of people who are just madmen. We are definitely fighting a religious war. And until we come to realize that, we are never going to be able to defeat it. In fact, we're encouraging the growth of a new generation of people who are going to fight us.
The U.S. is pulling its troops out of Iraq, but at the same time, it's boosting its military presence in the Persian Gulf. More ground troops are planned to be deployed. New drone bases are being built. What do you make of such expansion?
It just demonstrates again the ignorance of the United States government in terms of its political leadership about what our problem is in the Muslim world. The key point of formation for al-Qaeda was the presence of U.S. military forces on the Arabian Peninsula. 15 years after they declared war on us, we're now going to take people out of Iraq and put them in Kuwait and Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, reinforcing our presence on the Arab Peninsula. Only going to cause us more foes and more enemies in the Islamic world. It's a contradiction. It's a lack of common sense.
If the U.S. pulls out of everywhere,
yes,
is it going to be the end of terrorism?
It certainly would deny the terrorists the glue of unity that keeps them focused on the United States. If we weren't the main enemy, they would be attacking Israel, they would be attacking the Saudis, they would be attacking the Moroccans. The war would be...
And would you say let them attack the Israelis and the Saudis?
Let them go. Sometimes they say the Chinese will come in. I said, let the Chinese deal with these people for the next 50 years. We've had enough of it. But I think the point is the Americans can't get out. We're dependent on the Saudis to maintain our interests in the world oil market. And the Saudis buy, next to the Chinese, more of our debt than anyone else. So as long as we're side by side with the Saudis and with the Israelis, we're stuck in the Middle East, and America will continue to bleed.
Dr. Schroyer, thanks for the interview.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, boys and girls, I think you're beginning to understand why Tom Metzger hates the United States government. I began to dislike him intensely way back in the 60s. But I figured there was part of the U.S. government was okay, only the rest of them were bad. But as I've proceeded and educated myself over the years, I now am completely convinced I hate the United States government. Number one, they're not our government. They haven't been our government for a long time, so why worry about it? Don't feel bad about hating the United States government. A good share of the rest of the world does, too. I'll be back with you on Moon's Day. Yes. Have a good weekend. And see. No, I guess that's it. I haven't checked in on the Black KKK in Chicago for a few days. Monday I'll have to check out what happened on the weekend.
Reserves. Archers.
I beg pardon, sire. Won't we hit our own troops?
Yes, but we'll hit theirs as well. We have reserves.